From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made with an image on social media. A local racial justice advocate posted a split-screen photo on her Facebook page. On one side, Colin Kaepernick, the athlete, was kneeling on a football field. On the other side was a photo of a police officer kneeling on the neck of the late George Floyd. The woman who posted the image, who is white, said she wanted to raise awareness and show her support of the Black Lives Matter movement. But soon after she posted it, she heard from an African-American friend who asked her to take it down. She said the image was re-traumatizing and didn't consider the black perspective. The woman who posted the image said that conversation was humbling and uncomfortable, but also productive and important. She removed the image and had a talk with her friend. The two are Brighton residents and aligned in their racial equity work, but their life circumstances and worldviews are different, due at least in part to race. The two friends are joining us on the program this hour to share the kinds of conversations they've been having, and the Connections team thought they'd be valuable for our listeners to hear as well as we continue the work of embracing what might seem uncomfortable, the kinds of conversations that in the past maybe we just didn't want to have, but now we feel like we need it. Let me welcome both of those guests right now. Janita Anthony is a Brighton resident. Janita, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And welcome to Megan Clifford as well. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks so much.
And also joining us on the phone is Norman Simmons, a Rochester resident with his own powerful story who's been on this program in the past. Norman, welcome back to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, let me start with this. Megan, can you briefly describe what you wanted to do with that post that I described there? Make sure that the story was, that I was telling it fairly there.
Yeah, you had it pretty close to correct. I've spent a lot of time working for social justice issues throughout my life, and, I thought I was just doing, the right thing and bringing awareness to, everyone on my Facebook page, which I've seen a lot of my white friends doing, and I was, supported Colin Kaepernick, and I was like, this is a great analogy, looking at it, and didn't think another thing of it. And then Janita said to me, please take that down in a very gentle way. It's really traumatizing for me to see, my black brothers being murdered that way, and seeing that is re-traumatizing for me. And I was like, oh my goodness. Hello, there is my white privilege. I did not see it from Janita's point of view. And I thought all the reading I had done, all the activism I had done, and here I was still doing a racist thing. And so it opened up somewhat of a conversation between Janita and I about, wow, thanks for pointing that out. And I didn't see it that way. And I thought that was a really good learning experience for me.
Janita, can you take us through how that image and those, I guess, both of those images hit you?
Sure. So, I can talk a little bit about how, I opened up social media that morning and, we know what happened. And, picture after picture were these images of this man's life being stamped out. And so it just, for me, I feel like I've seen it. I've read it millions of times. I just don't need to see it. And every time I see it, I feel like it's just like a little notch that normalizes this concept of black pain and black struggle. So it becomes like, seen it, and it doesn't have as much meaning in my book. Like, for instance, in the 80s, we saw Ethiopians who were, you see these images of brown and black people just being starved or being victims of war, or being victims of violence. And so I just think that each little notch sort of psychologically in our head normalizes that violence against us. And, a friend of mine put it in a way like this. She said, I just felt like it was fetishizing black pain. Mm-hmm. And it was like this echo chamber on Facebook, one after the other. And I don't think just white people do it. I think we all do it. I think it gets in my head. When I see it, I'm more likely to see pain against, violence against black people as normal. So I don't necessarily think that, she was necessarily doing this consciously. Obviously not consciously, but this supremacist act, it's just the language that we use when we talk about black and brown people.
And if I could, Janita, I just want to explore the interaction that you had with Megan. I admire both of you tremendously for being able to have these kinds of, I think, tough moments when people may feel judged. And there's sort of an old saying that I've been trying to keep in mind lately, which is, you know, we should try to be slower to judge and quicker to forgive. And, you know, it sounds to me, Janita, like, you know, you know Megan at least enough to know that she wasn't trying to hurt somebody with this. So, you know, but you still had to deliver a message to her that it was potentially hurting people, yourself included. How do you navigate that? I mean, how much are you sort of packaging your words and your response based on how well you know somebody? How hard will you sort of clap back at someone if you don't know them well? Can you kind of take me through the mindset there?
Well, you know, initially I thought, and I know Megan, so I know that she comes from a place of love and sharing, and I could pick up on that right away. And so I wasn't offended by her act. I just wanted her to understand what it feels like for people of color, black people, brown people, to really the exchange always be about us having violence against us and then seeing that image. And me personally, I was raised in a household where we talked about race a lot from the moment I was very young. So I was, you know, conscious, and I'm comfortable with saying something to anyone. And, you know, I deliver it how I think it needs to be heard, that they can get what I'm saying more, you know, what they can hear what I'm saying best. So it's not like I'm not going to not deliver it, but I'm going to deliver it to my audience. And, you know, I thought it was very brave of Megan to say something to me, because she took it down and was like, I'm so sorry, you know, via social media. But she also took me aside personally and said, I just want you to understand that, you know, I didn't mean to do this. And I really appreciated that, because now we really do have an open dialogue about race. And I love that. I'll talk about it all day. I love to talk about it, because I think we can't talk about it enough so that we can do things, you know?
Well, let me ask Janita and Norman about this, and then we'll kind of get Megan's take. I'll start with you, Janita. You know, you are, in one sense, doing what you have to do to make sure that the message gets sent. In another sense, you're relying on Megan to sort of be a big enough person to say, okay, well-intended, but it was a misstep. I misstep. I do 500 hours of live radio a year. I mean, tremendous amount of missteps. I'm not, you know, proud of that or boasting about that. That's just reality. And listeners will absolutely let me know, which I appreciate. And I think that that's part of what the show is built on, is an understanding that as a white man with a microphone, there's a lot of privilege and power with that. And I will make mistakes, and I want to know when I do. But at the same time, I'm sure, Janita, there must be white people in your sphere who don't take criticism well. What do you generally say to maybe the white listeners in the audience who don't take it well if they're called out in any sort of way like that?
I think it's sort of like when you hold up a mirror and it's really painful. I know that, you know, and seeing the true nature is really painful to accept. I think it's just a matter of quiet listening, you know, because once you're defending yourself, you're not really hearing what the other person said. And, you know, you can look at it in any sort of disagreement you might have, you know, get past the fear of yourself, you know, the fear of who you might be. And it's okay, because, I mean, this is how we were socialized. We breathe and eat and drink racism, and we don't even know that we're ingesting it and then spouting it back out. So I just think it's important to hold a mirror up, and it's painful. It's painful for me. There are tons of things that I have ingested about racism and that I need to check myself and say, all right, no, like, you know, we could have a whole nother conversation about that.
Norman, how do you have those kinds of conversations, and generally what kind of reaction do you get?
I mean, it's so many angles that you can kind of take this whole race conversation. For me, for one, because I grew up in, you know, urban areas, but as I got older, you know, I played basketball with, like, a lot of white kids and was around their families. And I had Katie and Megan. I was around their family a lot. So my perspective is a little different than someone who black who necessarily grew up in an urban area, or somebody black who grew up maybe in a suburban area. I feel like I saw both worlds. So I try to just lean back on the idea that, you know, we're all people first. And this whole idea of race and the color, it's all made up. So essentially, that's where I start at. And then from there, you know, I feel as if someone is defending, you know, like this country, you know, because we learned a lot of lies and things we're unlearning now as a culture, as everybody, you know, is unlearning a lot of things. So if someone is constantly defending that, I just see them as just living in lies. So I don't give that too much energy to people that's kind of like trying to argue down what's the truth, you know, because it's only a matter of time before they'll be able to walk in their lives or live in the lie that they want to live in or the blanket. So I don't really give my energy too much to people that don't necessarily respond. But if it's somebody that's white who wants to learn and wants to get my experience, I'm all for that, even getting theirs as well, because I feel as if white people have something to give to the cause as well, even if they're not directly affected by racism, but they do reap benefits from the systems that's put in place. So them speaking out against it helps out as well. But as far as giving my energy to people who's so negative and so just so 1800 mindset, I just try to stay away from those people, mm-hmm. because you're not really changing too much of those mindsets.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And when you look at polling in the last month, I mean, since the murder of George Floyd, the change in attitudes among white people about a number of different issues have moved in just a few weeks as much or more than they moved in decades. It's really remarkable when you look at some of the polling about, you know, are people who are black treated differently by police? Are people who are black more likely to be roughed up or killed? You know, those kinds of things. And that has moved a tremendous amount in just a few weeks. And so, Norman, how do you decide whether it's worth having a conversation with someone? Because as you say, I mean, if someone's like sort of shut down immediately, or, you know, they don't seem open to it, it's a waste of your time and your emotional energy, I'm sure. But this is a country that has seen some movement in recent weeks. How do you decide if it's worth it?
Right. So, you know, I have a conversation with anybody and pick their brains. You know, I'm real observant. You know, I listen to verbiage. You know, I listen to how people kind of say things. And from there, I formulate my opinion from that, you know, from the bare minimum of a conversation, you know, like your take on the looting, or, you know, because the looting, of course, it happened, but the looting came from a place of people being fed up, you know. So the way people kind of convey their messages to me, I'll take it all in and I'll make a decision from there, because I can kind of tell the difference between someone, you know, genuinely, you know, talking and caring versus somebody who's just giving me the run around just to kind of have a conversation. I can read, see through that. So that's kind of how I hear everything. I take everything in and kind of make my opinions from that.
Mm-hmm. Megan, what was it like being on the receiving end of, you know, just some helpful criticism from Janita? And what do you think that maybe the larger point is that you try to carry forward with you when you get that kind of criticism?
Well, I think it's just important to name where I come from, too, to have an understanding. I was raised in Fairport, and I went to private school, so I'm very much on that. I call myself an owl, an old white liberal. So I'm of that mindset, and I've heard things over the weeks about, oh, you know, the old white liberal kind of, you know, justice, social justice warrior kind of thing, but you're not hearing us, or you're not really getting it. And I think, you know, and as much as I've done self-reflection and tried to be a part of an anti-racist movement, you know, I think I was kind of arrogant with that. And I think what Janita did was really remind me that I needed to be humble. You know, I thought, well, look at me. I've read all these books and I've gone to all these talks and, you know, I'm social justice is, you know, the core of my, you know, my value system. But you're never done learning, and you have to have the courage to have that humility and say, I screwed up, and I appreciate you, Evan, acknowledging that from your perspective, mm-hmm. but saying, you know, I screwed up, I did something wrong. And I think for me, it's really important for all groups to recognize that it's really important to pick out behaviors that people are doing versus saying, you know, you're racist or you're this, which comes across kind of like as a shaming thing, like there's something wrong with you. Versus being able to say, you know, I engage in this behavior that I now recognize is racist. Can you, you know, talk with me or help me understand? And just really having the humility. And I think I've, you know, been able to develop this over the years because I've had, like, Norman's been in my life since I was in my early 20s. And he and I, we have conversations and we have had these. And I can ask him flat out and he'll help me and he'll help me understand things from his perspective. Janita helped me understand things from her perspective. So I, you know, I think that relationship building is really important. And I think being mindful that, you know, education is important. You know, the reading of the books, those are just tiny little things that people are starting to do. It's what we're going to do afterwards, what actions we're going to engage in, and providing that education. And it gives people courage to ask to be called out or to be okay with being called out and not be defensive and say thank you for helping me understand that better. And that was something that really came across in my conversation with Janita. It was like, you know, get off your old white liberal horse that you think you know everything. And she said it very gently, but in my mind, that's what I said that to myself. You have a lot to learn, and you're always going to need to be learning. And, you know, I think of Ibram Kendi's work of how to be an anti-racist. You know, I realize, you know, I have a choice each day in each action that I make, if that's a, you know, anti-racist action or racist action. And to say that behavior or that action I took was racist doesn't make me be a, it's not, doesn't make me be a horrible person. I don't need to be defensive about that, but I need to acknowledge my behavior. And if I acknowledge it and say it out loud, take that feedback from my friends and other folks, you know, I can change. And I won't be defensive. I'll open up to that and be able to be a better ally.
Yeah. I think it's really wise. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you this hour. If you're having maybe more of the kinds of conversations and learning moments than maybe you did in the past, or how you're navigating those kind of conversations, what you think you're learning. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. And before I take our first phone call, let me just kind of build on something that Megan was saying, and I'll turn it back to Janita and Norman. You know, Janita, you show a lot of grace, of course, when you reach out to a friend and say, you know, hey, you might have meant well here, but this is not a good idea, and here's why. And I think, just from my own experience, I can probably point, maybe Megan's the same way, I can point to a number of either something I said or was called out on, and the way it felt, especially in a moment when it's really jarring, and maybe an initial defensiveness, and then later a realization that the person calling me out was right. Those things kind of stay with you, but they're really uncomfortable, especially in the moment. And I think probably the natural human thing is to think, well, I just don't want to deal with that. I don't want to confront that. I don't want to immerse myself. And so you avoid that. And I do think that's why we bubble up a little bit here. I also, though, think, Janita, that puts a lot of pressure on those who are calling out to sort of be graceful in the way you were about it and almost get tone policed. While I would salute the grace that you show, I wouldn't demand it, if that makes sense, because there's a right to be angry or hurt or exhausted. And I think sometimes white people, myself included, are like, well, you could have been nicer about that. Like, you could have said, you know, like, as if that's what was more important than the message. Does that make sense, Janita?
Absolutely. And at the same time, I just think that, you know, it's kind of like when you're dealing with your, not saying that you're my child, but when I deal with my children or whomever, I want the message delivered. So I'm going to deliver a message for it to be heard. And it's not that, you know, so when I saw it, I just couldn't literally control myself. When I saw it up, I was just like, hey, you know, to whomever. And to show, like, another instance, I was someone that I'm friends with on Facebook, and we're not good friends. And it was a white male, and he did the same thing. And I asked him nicely, and he was like, well, you know, good for you, but this is how I feel. I think that we need to see it. And then, you know, a lot of people responded like, keep rolling through and forget about it, and who cares. And so social media is just an area where, you know, a lot of things can be taken out of context, even if no matter what tone you say. So but for me, it's important to just, I want my message delivered, and I'm going to do that, you know, however I see fit.
And briefly, Janita, we had a guest on the program on Friday named Craig Carson, who he expressed to us that his view as a black man is that he doesn't mind kind of having to do some of the education and some of the heavy lifting of helping people see differently. But he also understands that some people who are black are tired of having to do that, feel like that shouldn't be my job. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I was
you know, singing from a soapbox for till my 20s, and then I got exhausted, and then, you know, I, for the past, I'd say, couple, like, decade or two, I've been like, I'm not educating everybody. It's not my job, and I'm exhausted, and I could care less if you feel that way. I'd rather know than not know. Now where I am, if I'm confronted with it, I will say something. I mean, it was interesting. Yesterday, we went to play frisbee golf, and we were near Henrietta, and there were, I guess, because it was Trump's birthday, there were a bunch of golf carts with, you know, Trump 2020 and American flags, and at this point, it's sort of unequivocal what that means to me personally. And, you know, as we walked by, some people, you know, one of the guys said, yeah, hello, and, you know, sure, hello. But if you want to engage me, I'll have a conversation, but I'm not going to go out of my way at this point. But I think, like Norman said, you can completely gauge where a person's coming from based on so many nonverbal things or the way they say it, or, you know. So I really, do I waste my time on someone who I see is completely unpersuadable? I don't know. It's a game time decision.
Fair enough. Norman, how do you feel about that?
I honestly feel that my tone, if I'm aggressive or if I come off the wrong way, I'm not really paying attention to that, because I have had times where I've dealt with the racism at hand. You know, I lived in Fairport, and I would get pulled over in the city because my license said Fairport, so they thinking I'm coming into the city to buy drugs, you know, or the fact that the school system is still the same way, the same way I was when I was a kid. You know, the fact that we're still learning about Christopher Columbus or things like that. We're not actively learning about Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey. So I feel as if I do try to get my message at all, the way it comes off is the way I meant it. You know, if then the person I'm talking to, they should know me. So, like, if I come off a way where it's aggressive to Megan, I'm pretty sure Megan won't take that the wrong way because she knows me and knows me. So I think on the other end, white people should get to know that person who's conveying the message a little more. Because a lot of it is us being tired and fed up of the things that we face, all because we're a skin tone, you know, all because we're a skin color, we face these different things, you know, like, it's so much stuff that we face where we can't get away from, you know. And so for me, that's where I kind of come from. If I'm coming off the wrong way to somebody, that's just where it's coming from. And then that can be a conversation where they can understand why it's coming off like that, versus me trying to sugarcoat or me trying to coddle people's feelings. I'm not really into that. Because this world is cruel, you know. This world is still doing so many nasty, negative things, and that's even being covered up, you know, to the killings of black men by the hands of police. So, for me, until the world gets more, I want to say, caring about how they deliver things or portray us in the media or whatever the case may be, my message and my tone won't change, because this is something that's dear to me. This is something I would die about, in the sense of equal rights, you know, equal things, you know, the racism. So my tone needs to be heard to know how serious I am about the matter, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it certainly does.
Yeah, and I'm just to say, you know, I don't sugarcoat it. I mean, I'm not saying that you were even saying that I was.
No,
I don't
no.
sugarcoat it, you know. And maybe it came across that way because I'm going to speak truth to power to whomever I need to. And,
right.
You know, and it will have urgency, and, you know, it will have what I feel, you know, appropriate at the time, but it's not like I'm changing necessarily my tone to make it more palatable to one group or to another group. It's just, you know, I agree with Norman. It's like, this is urgent.
Yeah.
People are dying every day.
And yeah.
Glad Janita took that tone with me. Not to interrupt. I'm glad she felt, you know, that she said, hey, take it down. You know, but I want, you know, I think that she should say it that way if that's how she feels. I think Norman should say things that way. You know, okay, sorry if it hurts my feelings. You know, too bad, Megan.
And I also think it's like a matter of just saying things that just flat out rude versus just the messaging being conveyed, you know, or heard the wrong way. I think there's two different things versus somebody just being rude about it, you know.
Sure, and the reason I brought up even the whole question of tone is I think, you know, probably if I'm being honest with myself over the years on this program, I might have noticed that I responded a little bit more openly if, let's say, an email came in that was critical of me but a little gentle in tone, as opposed to some of the more, hotter emails to come in, I've tried to train myself to, you know, ignore how whatever it makes me feel, is the point valid? Do I need to hear it? You know, and not sort of coddle myself with, well, they were nice about it, so I'll listen. And that has taken some work. And maybe it shouldn't take as much work, but it's still worth thinking about. So
can I just add something to take it back what you're speaking to? So I just was having this conversation with Megan. Yes, I feel like a lot of white people get the short end of the stick for trying to do what's right for them, you know? Like, even if they do something or say something that may be inappropriate at the time, that's just what they know. So my mentor, you know, Megan's sister, Katie, I feel as if sometimes she just stresses herself out, you know, how can she help out a little more to the cause? And when she's just being herself, being there for me and my friends and family, she's already helping to the cause. So I feel as if sometimes the white people who have good hearts get the short end of the stick for this whole cause, you know?
No, it's a powerful point too. I mean, so Norman, let me just respond to that by saying something that's going to be sort of clumsy. All right.
Okay.
There's a lot of conversation lately about the need for sort of emotional healing, not getting exhausted, giving yourself breaks, and I think you know it, to the extent that in the last few weeks I found myself kind of exhausted, I usually think to myself, "You got no right to be exhausted. You know, you're one of the most advantaged people in society." But I think everybody can have that moment where you know you do feel like you hit a wall with something. Everyone's got stuff in their life, and I think what you said there, Norman, is really graceful. So I try to balance that by saying, hey, we're all human. We're all going to, you know, hit a wall or, you know, have moments where we need to sort of recharge or feel like, you know, like we're not where we need to be. But I think you're showing a lot of grace. And I don't demand it, but I admire it. If that makes sense. So,
yeah.
Just really powerful conversation with Norman Simmons, Janita Anthony, Megan Clifford, talking about how we talk with one another, especially during the last several weeks of change and an opportunity, an open door for change in this country. And we've got some phone calls and emails that we can share. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we will come back and hit some of those phone calls right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we mark Juneteenth on Connections, America's second Independence Day. If you don't know the holiday, we'll talk about why it's celebrated on June 19th every year and why emancipation is viewed in light of that date, June 19th, 1865, not necessarily January 1st, 1863. We talk Juneteenth next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me go to Brian in Fairport first on the phone. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, you were in and out. Let's try it again, Brian. Go ahead.
Hello. This is Brian. Hi. I heard something a moment ago, Evan. There's been a lot of change over the last few weeks.
Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Evan, you were saying that over the last few weeks that you know, you felt that there had been a lot of change where for decades it seemed like there might not have been. I wanted to share that I feel that over the last few decades, I think that you know, people have just been becoming more and more fed up, and we've been having a lot of conversations. But what I feel I've seen in the last few weeks is that there's been more of a willingness for white people to, you know, break their silence on, you know, what we're seeing around us. And, you know, there's a character in an old book that's, you know, he says rhetorically, you know, if there's somebody defecating in my living room, am I supposed to just sit here and pretend that I don't see it? And I think that's what we feel. We felt, you know, it's just unacceptable to go on. And maybe it's been unacceptable. At the same time, I think that, you know, like you said, we're exhausted. And, you know, we just, at some point, for whatever reason, you just say, enough is enough. So I think that I see a change in some behaviors, in some speech, and in breaking silence. I hope that the attitudes are the same, and it's just people that have been silent that now know to speak up. So I just wanted to share that there's another resource. You know, my wife and I are having these conversations all the time, and one resource that we found recently that I think is very helpful is this podcast called Seeing White. And I think that it's something that, you know, for people, you know, in America, you know, where the system of racism and slavery and whiteness was invented, you know, I think we should listen to that. We should discuss it, you know, in our, you know, with our white friends and get to know that. And, you know, maybe then, you know, we'll be a little bit better prepared to talk about some of these things. I think that, you know, informing ourselves and, you know, thinking about, you know, what are the things that need to be in the curriculum when we talk about American history and, you know, some of the, you know, sort of like Daniel Boone and Paul Bunyan stuff, the way that the stories, you know, were presented, you know, when we're growing up. And, you know, how are we going to teach our kids about it, whether it's in school or at home, and, you know, find resources to educate ourselves better.
Well, and Brian, before I let you go, I appreciate the phone call. When you say that, and I'm glad you're calling, especially as a caller from the suburbs. I mean, this is what we talked about on Friday on this program. Are we going to see movements actually permeate the predominantly white Rochester suburbs? If you are seeing a change in the way that people are more willing to speak out, white people included, what's an example? What do you mean exactly by that?
You know, the other day a bunch of people got together out here in Potter Park to say that, you know, we stand with our, you know, our family, you know, here, our 50th cousins and whatnot, and the people in our community, we stand with them to say that, you know, it's not acceptable for, you know, a human in this country to not have equal rights under law. So, you know, hundreds of people are willing to go out and say something on a Sunday. I think, you know, a lot of people were getting out there and making posters and you know, creating artwork to try to express some of the hope and also some of the pain and the anger and the frustration. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think you know, we had some of our neighbors that weren't on the same page about it, and you know, we got together and talked about it, and you know, everybody understood that, you know, we need to be behind this message, and so those are good conversations, you know, that we need to be having.
Yeah. Brian, thank you. Let me turn it over to our guests. Janita, I'll start with you. You know, so he's talking about a suburban perspective, but saying you're actually seeing hundreds of people show up in a lot of different local towns, not just urban centers in this country. You see more white people willing to speak out. The polling reflects changing attitudes. Do you sense that? Do you feel that from your perspective, Janita?
I mean, I do feel like there is a movement. I mean, you look at London, Berlin, Syria, every town in the United States has had protests. So I think there, you know, a lot of silence for, you know, in the 60s, there was a lot of white silence about these things going on. And the fact that, you know, in, let's say, Idaho, we have people, or Iowa, people out in the streets, there's, you know, hope that this will change to policy and to action. But there is definitely more people than I've ever seen, more people having conversations than I've ever seen in my lifetime. I can say I'm hopeful, but, you know, again, this is America, so sometimes that hope can turn into, you know, we have an election coming up. Let's see if people put in the action and the work behind their words.
Okay. Norman, how do you feel about it? Did we lose Norman? Are you there, Norman? You might be on mute.
I just didn't want my background. So.
No, that's okay.
Interrupt.
No problem.
But I love the fact that, you know, he took the time to call in. Just in that, it just made me smile. Because like I said, everybody has a part to the puzzle. Even if he's out in the suburbs doing what they're doing, they're making someone uncomfortable who is stuck in that state of mind. And that's why me and Megan had a conversation yesterday. You know, do I ever think, you know, the white liberal should just sit down and be quiet? And I don't ever think it's a time where nobody should be sitting down and be quiet. We all have information. We all have stuff where we can teach each other and learn. So I really applaud and I admire the fact that people who are white are going out their comfort zone to to actually take a stand for the cause, even though they may have been taught otherwise, you know, their whole lives. You know, that takes a lot of self-checking, you know, it takes a lot of put your pride aside to do that, you know, and it's definitely, it helps the growth of all of us at the end of the day. So I really admire it, and thank you for calling to even share that.
What do you think, Megan Clifford? Are you also on mute? Where's Megan? Do we have Megan Clifford? My board says we do.
Can you hear me?
I can now.
Can you hear me?
There you are.
Okay. I must have hit mute by accident as well. So, I was actually raised in Fairport in the 80s and 90s. And I'll give you an example. I was driving through Fairport actually on Sunday. And on the corner of Turk Hill and Arault, there was a large group of folks with signs saying, like, honk for BLM and, you know, and there must have been 40 or 50 cars that went through that intersection. And I maybe heard 6 or 7 of them honk. And immediately I thought, you know, I was just really discouraged and really saddened. I thought, there's 50 cars here. And I really don't, I think education is important. That's the standoff. I think conversations are important. But, you know, white people, what are you going to do with your time, with your money, with your privilege and connections? What are you going to do, you know, when, you know, I'm thrilled that there has been this response, but what are you going to do? Are you going to help register people to vote? Are you going to give money to candidates outside of our, you know, outside of New York State where we're so blue? You know, what are you going to do 6 months from now, a year from now, to continue to be anti-racist? And I think a really small caveat was, during COVID, I wasn't running my kids all around here and there everywhere. It actually afforded me more time to do these things. What happens when I got to be running here and there with my kids to sports and dance and all that stuff? Am I going to put those things to the side because I'm too busy or it's inconvenient now? And that's where I, you know, that's what I want to say to white people. Put your money where your mouth is. Put your action where your mouth is. Put your reading, you know, where put that in action. Because we can't just let this conversation die out and go back, you know, to the way we have been for 400 years.
Hmm. Let me get back to the phones. George and Geneseo next. Go ahead, George.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Evan had Sergeant Marv on, black retired police military person,
mm-hmm.
and I was exceedingly impressed with his eloquence and his use of correct grammar much better than my children. But 50 years ago, when I was in college, doing that would have been called acting white. And I'm thinking that part of one of the racial fears of a lot of white people, particularly the less educated one, is all of the numerous eloquent, intelligent black voices that we hear speaking nowadays. And I really appreciate a different point of view analysis of everything from climate change to race relations and from all these eloquent black voices. But I think that is another racial fear that is part of the racism that we see in a lot of whites.
Well, so I want to make sure I understand what you're saying here, George. First of all, so forgive me and just help me understand a little bit. So if you hear a black guest on this program and they speak with grammar that your perception isn't sort of top shelf, do you assume less of them or their intelligence?
Oh, no. There are very intelligent people that speak with good grammar, intelligent people that speak with poor grammar. That's not what I'm saying at all. I mean, Marv was a thoughtful person, but also was much better spoken than many of the white people that we see criticizing the white supremacist voices that we see. And I think that's one of the racial prejudices of a lot of these whites is that they are afraid of the smarter blacks. I'm just that's exactly what I'm pointing out. They absorb the education, and they speak well eloquently. We've got eloquent speakers who don't have such great grammar, but that are that's why essentially what I'm saying is pointing at a source of additional source of racial fear. It used to be that the black men were being picked on because they were thought to be a threat to white women. It wasn't as physical violence, it's intellectual violence that whites are afraid of now as well.
Okay, I think I'm following the point, and I would just add, and I don't know where you are in this though, George. We also need to, I think, and this is me being a little preachy here, but we need to get away from what has been a very white-centered view of what is quote unquote good or correct when it comes to grammar, communication, etc. There are people who can speak very, very clearly and communicate very, very clearly and effectively, and it isn't necessarily the type of grammar you would use, but it doesn't mean that they are not a brilliant communicator. And I do think that some of what we deem to be correct or right or good is centered in a very narrow viewpoint. I don't know how you feel about that, George.
Well, I'm saying that the single point I'm making is the fear of whites of the intellectual thoughts, as well as the
George, your phone's cutting a little bit here, so I appreciate the call as far as I can understand it. I'll turn it over to our guests here, and let me also say, because I know that there will be retired English teachers who will email me, and I welcome it. That's great. I am not someone who doesn't care about quality communication. I'm saying that what we deem to be quality communication has been pretty narrow for a long time, and I think we need to maybe understand the history of that is all. And I've had to learn that. I've had a lot to learn them. Janita, what did you make of George's call?
Well, I got lost when he began. So it was a little tough for me, but definitely, the way that people of African descent speak, it's definitely been a way for people to dismiss our genius and brilliance. You know, we weren't brought to this country because we weren't brilliant. We were a very important commodity. You know what I mean? Our brilliance was the commodity that was used, to create this country. So, language and people of African descent is definitely a sore point for me, because I just think it's another way to dismiss our greatness.
Okay, Norman Simmons.
I think he made a lot of points. I'm just going to touch on a few. So as far as like intellect, I definitely agree. I feel as if, whoever it is, a part of, the white supremacist of America, do feel as if black men getting to a certain point, they do feel as if it's a threat. We can look back, whether, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, powerful men who was actually organizing to bring better things to our people, and they were actually brought down by the government, CIA, where it's actually known facts if people did their research. So that type of stuff shows that America's been scared of the black man. Even myself, in a sense, I come from the hood, I come from areas, broken families, my dad was in jail since I was two. I learned to articulate myself, based on my environment, so I didn't necessarily learn to talk well from reading books. I learned to talk, because I knew where I wanted to get in life. I didn't learn to talk well because I thought I would be accepted into America. It just naturally happened in my path of life, and also with all the trauma, I've been shot before and all these different things, and I still was able, to get through college, on a master's degree level, so the grit that we have is unmatched, from slavery to now, all the things that we developed from those times is what America is scared of, I really believe. So that's why the media shows us the way they do, and things are set up in the way that they are. The education system is no better, in Pittsburgh, Brighton, they're not learning the same things as the city schools. And that to me, that doesn't make sense. So ideally, I do think America is scared of the black intellect. Even myself right now, I go through a lot of loopholes because I feel like a lot of times I'm on both sides. I can relate to people in the hood. I can wear a do-rag, and I also can wear a suit and tie and keep up a conversation with that intellectual white man.
So I get two sides of it, whether from a white man, whether they're fascinated with the fact that, you know, I carry myself so well. They're just so surprised. Or some white men that try to challenge me, and then when they see I'm able to hold my weight, you can see that they start to change how they approach me. So I do, ideally, to make it short, that America is scared of the black man that's strategically smart and has an understanding of the way the world is.
Okay. Megan, what did you make of that call?
I agree with that. What brought that up for me was, I remember when I first was taught, when I first learned what white privilege was, it was 1992, and I was in a college class called Race in American Politics. We read Peggy McIntosh, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. And I remember saying in that class that nothing is going to change until white people are willing to give up what they have to make things equal. And I still believe that. I think we don't want to give anything up. We don't want to be uncomfortable. Maybe I should say this is my opinion, my perspective. When it really comes down to giving things up, I don't really think white people are willing to do that. And that's what discourages me. Whether it be their money, their time, you know, I don't see that enough from a wider, and I also think that has to do somewhat with rugged individualism, and I'm only going to take care of me, which Norman spoke to about caring for just one another as humans. So that's what always sticks with me is that action piece. What are you going to give up? Are you willing to give something up? And so, you know, unfortunately, I don't see that.
And so, Megan, it's funny you say that. I don't mean to cut you. I just want to add something. So I see, like, it's a lot of, you know, protests and people standing up and serving. So I'll push it a step further and ask, so why don't you guys organize and give, you know, some of your funds from your district to a district that's hurting in the city? Because that's what it all boils down to, education, probably, you know, all that type of stuff. So.
All right, well.
Or county schools.
Go ahead, Janita.
Or county schools, you know, this notion has worked in other areas where you spread, you know, a lot of this money around the county so that it's not, you know, concentrated in one area or some money's a lack of concentration in another area, you know. That was sort of my take a little bit on education. You know, how do we get equity for education and housing? And there's so many ways that we need to tackle and so many issues that we need to tackle, but we need to put in the work, like Megan said, put in the action, follow through on it. And it might be little everyday things that we have to do, but we have to do it because some people are doing it, but they're doing like a lot of the work for the other people who are not doing it. So I just think, you know, it's important we have to work together and do it.
Got a few minutes left here, and there's a lot of different ways we can go here. And I'm so grateful for our guests, for the conversation they have brought to us and frankly, the wisdom they bring to us. Wendy sends a note to the program to say, it is not a privilege to live in a racist society, no matter who you are. White people need to understand it helps no one. I think, Wendy, I understand the goal of the point there. It is a noble one. But I think this has been zero sum, and I think to Megan Clifford's point, in a racist society, maybe what you're saying is eventually inequality will collapse on itself, and eventually it can't stand, and so therefore it would benefit nobody because, you know, you can give all the power and the privilege to a certain group of people or a family in a caste system, whatever the case is, but. If that's the case, it's going to collapse on itself. Maybe that's the point you're making, Wendy. But for too long, there has been privilege and real benefit and advantage. And to Megan's point, it has to be something that people are willing to give up. Janita, do you see it that way? The people, if we're going to see a movement toward actual equality, that there has to be sort of a zero sum and that some people have to be willing to give up some of what they have.
Definitely. I mean, if we look at some of the benefits, you know, the benefits that people have received as a result of white supremacy, and there's no way that things can continue as they are. You cannot. I mean, this is not even a debate. It should not even be a debate about how we figure out how to right this wrong. And, you know, there's so many benefits that, you know, even that we don't even notice that are occurring. And these support systems have to be put towards resources in Black areas and Brown areas where we are struggling. And I definitely, I agree with that.
Norman, do you see it that way, that people have to be willing to give something up, something, the kind of advantage that they've had for a long time, and give up tangible things in some ways?
I'm sorry, not to cut you off, but you
Sorry,
I'm just sorry. Norman, I'm not cutting you off, I'm sorry, but I just, you know, you gain when you give. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's a loss. I don't think it's a loss. I think it's a gain. So, sorry.
Norman. No. Well said. Norman?
And yeah, I agree. To me, it's just all about the next generation after this. So I'm thinking about the kids, you know. All kids should have, you know, the same equal opportunity. Every kid that comes into this world, they don't think nothing about anything. You know, they're kind of molded by the world. So if we kind of think about that and understand that, if we kind of try to change some things, kids growing up, you know, now won't grow up like, you know, our grandparents or, you know, our aunts and uncles or mothers, you know, in the same type of environment, because we're trying to change the climate. Definitely people in positions of power need to start, you know, sacrificing things as well. Or I don't see no big monumental change if we don't start hitting it where it really matters, and that's economically and educational-wise. You know, there's a lot of my people that I know go to college that's Black, don't necessarily have the funding. They take out, you know, loans, and then they're in debt, and they don't even finish school. So those type of things take into consideration. And we can talk for hours. So I definitely agree. People who are fortunate enough definitely should start looking to give back in ways if they're fortunate enough to do so.
Well, and as we get ready to wrap the program, when you think about some of the context of the last 10 minutes here, you start to see what might be one-off stories in a different light. And I'll share an example that just hit half an hour ago. And I'm going to be careful here as we wrap this program. YMCA, call me. Correct the record on this. But a member of the YMCA and a member of the county legislature, Rachel Barnhart, just tweeted half an hour ago. She spoke with someone at the Y who said only Carlson and Monroe branches will be closed to members through the fall. Other branches are going to be open. So you think about the massive branches out in Penfield and Pittsford for the Y. According to Rachel, they're going to be open. Branches in the city, closed. What, you know, you start to see things in different lights. And I think they better answer that. Now, if that's wrong, I will correct the record on the air here. And I always want to be careful with that. So YMCA, doors open. Please let us know if that's wrong. But we're thinking about who has the advantage, who benefits, who's held back. Small examples, but they add up in a society in a lot of different directions. And the question is, who's willing to say so? And I will definitely correct it if I'm wrong. And by the way, I'm wrong a lot. And I hope I'm wrong on this one. I want to thank our guests for the time and the wisdom this hour they've shared with us. Janita Anthony and Megan Clifford kicked it off, I think, really, really effectively. And I appreciate both of you sharing not only that story, but talking about your perspectives. Janita, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Megan Clifford, same. Thank you very much, Megan.
Thank you, Evan.
Norman Simmons, a Rochester resident, and also a longtime friend of Megan, sharing his perspective. Norman, I hope we can see you soon. Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you for having me.
All right, more connections. We're talking Juneteenth next.